Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
In the 9 years since the dramatic and suicidal terrorist attacks on the World Trade Center and Pentagon on September 11, 2001, scholars have devoted greater attention to unraveling several of the mysteries surrounding this form of conflict. First, why would an organization such as Al-Qaeda or Hamas send some of its most active and loyal members on suicide missions? What type of person would be most willing to volunteer for such a mission, and how do radical organizations recruit these members? And why, in recent decades, have terrorist groups been largely, though not exclusively, affiliated with radical religious groups? To discuss these questions, I am pleased to be joined today by Ellie Berman, professor of economics at the University of California at San Diego, and author of Radical, Religious, and Violent, The New Economics of Terrorism, published by the MIT Press, which we'll have a link to up on our website. I should also mention that Professor Berman is the Research Director of International Security Studies at the University of California's Institute on Global Conflict and Cooperation as well, so he knows his stuff about conflict, cooperation, and terrorism here. Ellie, welcome to Research on Religion.
Tony, it's great to be with you.
Now, it might seem a bit odd to be interviewing an economist on the topic of religious terrorism. When one hears a story about a suicide bombing in the news, I think our immediate reaction tends toward questioning the psychological or perhaps theological motivations behind the attack. Rarely would our thoughts drift to the cold, hard, rational logic of cost-benefit calculations, which tends to be the mainstay of economic analysis. But your book, which I recently had the pleasure of discussing at an academic conference, provides a number of really interesting insights into the success of these radical religious movements based upon the institutional incentive structures that they create and their enormous success at solving what economists call, or political scientists and sociologists call it, the collective action problem, or as folks might just call it straight out, cooperation. So we want to talk about how these groups are actually good at doing it and what role religion might play. But before we talk about that, maybe we should start with a few basic definitions surrounding the topic. And let me, obviously, the definition we need to think about is terrorism. So what's your working definition of terrorism?
Well, Tony, can I just start by commenting on something you just said?
Sure, no problem.
Everyone's always trying to squeeze the economists out of discussing people they think are crazy.
Yeah.
And so as if, you know, we're only responsible for people making mundane decisions.
Right.
Like, you know, which breakfast cereal to eat or which do you want to, which, what kind of health insurance to choose or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But this is one of my favorite myths that I think needs busting about terrorists as individuals.
Mm-hmm.
That the evidence we have, which is pretty clear on this, I think, is that terrorists, even suicidal terrorists, are not typically crazy people.
Right.
There's a wonderful, it's an unfortunate, but there's a fairly large sample of failed suicide terrorists, people that got on the bus, pressed the button, and it didn't go off, who've been interviewed.
Mm-hmm.
Ariel Mirari has done this in Israel, and what he'll tell you is that under other circumstances, this guy's a psychologist, he says under other circumstances, I wouldn't ask these people to come back for a second visit in my office because they don't have any particular psychological psychosis, or anything like that.
Right.
They're not crazy people.
And what about the other common thought that we have, that these people are down and out on their luck, they're the lowest in the socioeconomic ladder, and, you know, they have no other options?
Zero evidence for that.
Really?
Well, in fact, we know that Atta was, in fact, a millionaire.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But I think people want to think carefully about this from an organizational point of view, which I know was the point of your question, and I promise to get back to it.
Mm-hmm.
If you're an organization, so first of all, if you're an organization, you're going to send people off to do something which is difficult and which exposes the organization to great danger if they get caught and get interrogated and might rat you out, then you would send people who are, first of all, competent.
Right.
And second of all, you would send people who you think are very loyal.
Mm-hmm.
All right? So that argues against kind of picking up someone off the street who's down on his luck.
And those people tend to be a lot more random, unpredictable, and yeah, exactly.
Right. Or sending some crazed individual who thinks that the Almighty is kind of whispering in his ear.
Mm-hmm.
So those make great characters on B-movies,
mm-hmm.
but terrorist organizations tend not to choose those folks.
Right.
And probably for very good reasons.
And so some of the reasons we're going to cover, and one of the illuminating aspects of your book is that you do bust a lot of these myths and talk about the organizational aspects of this, really how they condition individual behavior, which is absolutely fascinating. But let me get back to the issue of terrorism. What are we talking about when you talk about terrorism?
So what do we mean by terrorism? Now, I think I kind of want to take myself off the hook.
Okay.
For legal scholars, terrorism means something very specific.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're talking about, because if you call somebody a terrorist, you trigger the ability of states to take all kinds of licenses in how they treat that individual.
Mm-hmm.
We can incarcerate them without the usual rights. We can, the targeted assassination might be permissible. So you know, you or I, Tony, would be very sensitive about whether we were called a terrorist or not, just because of the legal aspect of it.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, as an academic, looking at the behavior of these folks, well, what you find is that people who conduct acts which we would all agree are terrorism,
mm-hmm.
right, targeting civilians for a political purpose,
right,
those organizations also generally conduct acts which we would call insurgency,
mm-hmm.
targeting the military, or using means that don't cause mass casualties.
Mm-hmm.
So the folks that sometimes put a suicide bomber in a cabin of a van, fill the van with explosives and go, and he goes and drives that thing, you know, God forbid, into an embassy or into a UN installation, those same groups will also ambush the patrol, mm-hmm. which we would usually call insurgency.
Right.
And so from my point of view, it's not particularly useful from an analytic point of view to distinguish
mm-hmm.
between terrorists and insurgents, since these same folks, you might want to call them rebels, are often using both tactics.
Mm-hmm.
And that's true of Al-Qaeda, it's true of the Hezbollah, it's true of the Taliban, it's true of, I think, any organization, almost any organization you could think of
mm-hmm.
that carries out terrorism.
Well, one of the interesting points you make in your book, and I love this question, and I love the technique of asking a question a different way, is not why there are so many terrorist attacks, but rather why there are so few. It seems, you know, we see this in the news all the time. You say, oh, these terrorist attacks must be increasing, or they're very frequent in that. But, you know, when you come to think about this, many of the attacks that they engage in, you could think of any schmuck with some fertilizer, gasoline, and a match could become a terrorist. And in that light, when you think about it that way, it's amazing you don't see more of this. And so the question becomes, why not?
Yeah, and that's a fantastic question. Because and once you ask it that way, I think you're on the way to understanding some very basic things about the vulnerabilities of terrorist organizations.
Mm-hmm.
So if you look at a particular terrorist attack, without going into details about how exactly it was done, which maybe we don't want to talk about on the radio too much,
mm-hmm.
but if you look at how the attack is done, you probably figure out that you and I, Tony, with a little ingenuity and surfing the web a little bit, and a credit card and a Home Depot trip
mm-hmm.
could probably carry these things out.
Mm-hmm.
And so you say, well, the constraint on the amount of terrorism is not the technology. The technology is pretty simple.
Mm-hmm.
It turns out that it's also not recruiting individuals who are willing to do these things for a cause. And that's a sad and scary thought.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it is the case that, and we have some evidence on this, that there are many people who are willing to give their lives to a cause if they think that it will further the liberation of them and their friends, or end the suffering of their families, or get the occupying force out of their countries, or whatever the cause is.
Mm-hmm.
So lots of individuals, simple technology, what stops there from being more terrorism
right.
than we actually see? Now, if you ask it that way, it does sound scary, but here's the good news. There are only 42 organizations on the State Department's list of FTOs, foreign terrorist organizations.
Mm-hmm.
These are the folks who are designated as terrorists, and for all the legal reasons we were discussing earlier, many things can be done to them. Their assets, their people can basically be snatched at will
mm-hmm.
and detained for who knows how long.
Mm-hmm.
But only 42. And actually, now that the Tamil Tigers are gone, I think we're down to 41. Mm-hmm. Of those, the top five or six on the list account for more than 80% of the casualties.
Mm-hmm. And what would be some of these groups? Now, you mentioned the Tamil Tigers, and that's an interesting group that is a secular Marxist organization that was in operation in Sri Lanka for the past few decades, if I'm correct. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. The Tamil Tigers, or the LTTE.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they're totally secular. They did engage in suicide attacks. So if you thought that suicide attacks only involved Muslims who thought that the Almighty was whispering in their ear, then no, that's not the case.
Right.
The majority of suicide attacks were actually carried out by secular terrorists
mm-hmm.
through the 1980s.
Mm-hmm.
And that's mostly the Tamil Tigers. And mounted both terrorist and insurgent organizations, conventional insurgency, is what they did when they could ambush the Sri Lankan forces,
mm-hmm.
and were successfully suppressed only over the last 2 years.
And let me ask the interesting question about suicide bombing. It's a fascinating aspect. You know, why is this technique used in some situations and not others? It seems like such a, you know, from the organizational aspect, it's such a waste of resources of, you know, sending somebody out to blow themselves up. Why not just send themselves out to drop a bomb on a bus and then get out of there?
If I can, Tony, let me answer you in two pieces.
Okay.
Because I feel I didn't finish the answer to a previous question about why so few organizations.
Well, I think we're going to come back to that, when you were talking about okay. the defection constraint.
Terrorism
but...
and suicide mm-hmm. terrorism.
Mm-hmm.
Terrorism in general and suicide terrorism in particular, no lack of recruits. Technology is fairly straightforward. So why do we see so little of it? Well, I think this is a key issue, that from an organizational point of view, if you think of yourself, and this is social scientists, right, I think, this is our advantage in the world. If you put yourself in the shoes of the people that have to run these organizations, they've got problems.
Right? Mm-hmm.
They have to somehow recruit individuals who are willing to carry out the attack without, well, resisting the urge to sell the organization out to the other side, to our side.
Mm-hmm.
And they know full well that our side is willing to pay tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of dollars for information that will lead to the prevention of an attack that that seriously endangers people from the first world. We're willing to pay a lot of money to preserve the lives of our folks.
Mm-hmm. And so what you're talking about is something you mentioned in your book, you call the defection constraint, that there's very strong incentives for any individual within one of these militant organizations to defect, especially when, you know, a Western government is promising $1 million to turn yourself in before you engage in your mission.
Right. So I'm the attacker. I could either endanger myself and carry out the attack, or I could make a lot of money and go into witness protection somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, especially for people that come from very poor backgrounds, you might think that defection constraint will really bind. And the way that it would bind is that the organization had better think twice about sending me out to attack something when the value of the information that I now hold exceeds the value to me of actually carrying out the attack.
Mm-hmm.
And that effectively constrains them in the amount of damage they can send me, Ellie the attacker, out to do.
Mm-hmm. And so you tell a really interesting story about the Taliban and how this actually operates. You could, in your book, could you go through that for our listeners here?
Yeah. So what I outline is really goes back to the early days of the Taliban.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that the Taliban originally created themselves and started successfully governing Afghanistan by doing one simple thing, which was creating a one toll road through that ran from southern Afghanistan, from Kandahar,
mm-hmm.
Through to western Afghanistan, to Herat, and then off into Iran and up into the stands.
Mm-hmm.
And why was a one toll road so important? Well, because previously there had been a multiple toll road where when a truck drove down the road, they had to pay every warlord along the way every time, you know, they came to a checkpoint that might have a couple of kids with Kalashnikovs at it.
Mm-hmm.
And they would just successively extort this poor trucker until there was no value left in his truck by the time it got to Iran.
And so, obviously, nobody would ever want to take a trip on this road with their goods and services.
Absolutely. Very bad for business.
Yeah.
And so, now, but that means that if you can open the road and guarantee that the trucks will be safe all the way through, then you can create something that's good for business, and that would also be good for whoever runs the road. They could charge very high tolls at their one toll station,
mm-hmm.
which might be at the beginning, say, in Kandahar or even in Quetta in Pakistan before they got started.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but then, if you could, so, but what would it take to actually open up the road? Well, you'd have to make sure that at every place where somebody might want to set up an extortionary check post, you've got your people, and they're not extorting the truck.
Right.
And that means that, how are you going to keep your folks in line? So first you have to conquer the road, but assume they can do that.
Mm-hmm.
How are you going to keep your guys in line and keeping them from jumping in the cab, grabbing the goods, and driving the truck off into Iran and selling it for all it's worth? Well, if you're going to be, to be able to do that, you have to make sure that you can keep your folks loyal.
Mm-hmm.
And this, again, harkens back to that question of, can you trust the people that are working for you?
Mm-hmm.
So just like a terrorist might want to sell out to the CIA or Iraqi intelligence or Afghan intelligence for the reward, so the guy who's supposed to be guarding the truck might want to sell out or just grab the truck and sell it.
Yeah.
How do you keep these guys from defecting for money? And mm-hmm. every organization that we know about that's been studied carefully has this problem
mm-hmm.
and has had cases of people defecting and selling out for money, including Al-Qaeda and the Hezbollah.
Mm-hmm.
So how do they solve this problem? Excuse me a moment, there's an airplane overhead. We're on the takeoff path of a Marine base here in San Diego. Okay, how do you solve that problem? Well, you have to recruit very carefully.
Mm-hmm.
And what the Taliban managed to do was to recruit people that already kind of signaled their commitment to the organization
mm-hmm.
by spending an awful long time in the madrasas and the refugee camps on the Pakistani side of the border. These are Afghan refugees in Pakistan. And what they did when they spend all those years not accumulating human capital was they kind of doomed themselves to be really bad candidates for witness protection.
Mm-hmm.
So imagine that, you know, if you sell the information or if you grab the truck and you drive it into the next country, well, you're not going to come back to the old refugee camp.
Right.
Right? So you're going to have to be able to live somewhere else, speaking maybe a different language, and you're going to need some basic skills.
Running a barber shop or a bakery or something.
Exactly. You're going to need, like, basic accounting and how to, you have to be able to talk to people and kind of make small talk in some other language. Right? And that's going to be a problem if you didn't learn anything in school.
Mm-hmm.
So this, if you will, is kind of the equivalent of barefooted in the kitchen. By developing and recruiting cadres who have very poor opportunities outside the organization, you manage to keep them loyal to the organization,
mm-hmm.
not selling you out.
And you also, in part, this might get us to the topic of why religious groups are so effective at mobilizing or actually recruiting people and retaining them within their organization. And is the lesson from the Taliban portable to other organizations?
Yeah, absolutely. So what we found is that radical religious groups mm-hmm. who provide social services, surprisingly enough, are more ambitious in the attacks that they carry out and more lethal when they do carry out those attacks.
Mm-hmm.
That includes both suicide and non-suicide terrorism.
Mm-hmm.
That would be the Hezbollah, the Hamas, to some extent Sadr's militia
mm-hmm.
in Iraq, Al-Qaeda Iraq, though they provide very poor social services, and the Taliban. Now, it also extends to groups, that are not Islamists, and though they are radicals in a different way. And I'm thinking here of Aum Shinriko,
mm-hmm. in Japan,
who had in the sarin gas attack on the Tokyo subway. That was a method and a target which had the potential to be even more lethal than the September 11th attacks.
Mm-hmm.
So, and what's interesting about this is that radical Islamists who do not provide social services, like the Palestinian Islamic Jihad, this is a group that has the same theology as Hamas.
Mm-hmm.
They're Sunni, radical Sunni Islamists who aspire to have to a caliphate or to an Islamic state in Palestine, but they don't provide the social services. Are actually no more. They don't fall in this category of very lethal organizations. They're in fact no more lethal than the secular nationalists. So the key issue here doesn't seem to be, or the key predictor of lethality, doesn't seem to be the ideology at all.
Mm-hmm.
It has to do with the tightness of the group, and the tightness of the group. And this is something we know from the sociology of religion and the economics of religion.
Mm-hmm.
The tightness of the group is reflected in their ability to provide social services through mutual aid, something which is not only a Muslim Brethren or a radical Islamist trait. We also find it among ultra-Orthodox Jews, among Hutterites and Mennonites and Amish, all forms of Pennsylvania Dutch and Anabaptists.
That was one of the most fascinating aspects of your book. I think most people will pick up the book, you know, to read about the economics of terrorism, as your book is subtitled. But you tell a story how you originally got into this issue of religion and economics by observing ultra-Orthodox Jews in Israel and how they're able to successfully bring people in to their organization, provide social welfare services. Tell us a little bit about that, and that I think that is going to lead us down the road to understanding how other organizations provide these services as well.
Yeah, so this is just a fascinating, benign story. The bus on the way to the Hebrew University on Mount Scopus passes through an ultra-Orthodox neighborhood where you've probably seen these folks in movies. Think of the Hasidim
mm-hmm.
or Misnagdim, and the way you would see them in New York or in many American cities. People dressed in black, pretty much from head to toe, with wide-brimmed hats that make them look like Polish noblemen.
Mm-hmm.
Even in summer, in the heat of Jerusalem or Brooklyn, these guys are always dressed in black.
Yeah, and that's...
And the women very modestly dressed,
mm-hmm.
Though fashionably, right,
mm-hmm.
with very little skin showing,
mm-hmm.
right, the hands and the faces. And now, so the bus drives through these neighborhoods on the way to the university, and it's really kind of like a little nature preserve. It's a different world living within Jerusalem. So I was always a little interested. And one summer, we discovered that that you could actually identify in the labor force survey, in the Israel labor force survey, these families. So you knew when you were looking at the household survey results.
Mm-hmm.
Whether this was an ultra-Orthodox family or not, just because they asked a question about last school attended. And if last school attended was yeshiva, then you know you'd identified one of these families.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, being a labor economist, the first thing I did when I realized this was I went and I threw the disk into my computer and could quickly calculate how many children on average these families were having, what their earnings were on average, and how many years they were spending in yeshiva, is studying before going out to work. And what we discovered was just hair-raising. We discovered that in this subpopulation, which is about 5% of Israeli Jews at the time. Two-thirds of the men weren't working because of two-thirds of prime-age males, say men that are too old for college and too young to be retired,
mm-hmm.
ages 25 to 54. Two-thirds of these men were not working because they were studying in yeshiva.
Mm-hmm.
They were pursuing religious studies.
And that's got to be a big drain on their family income.
Yeah, so then we started asking, well, hold it a sec, how do these families survive?
Mm-hmm.
And then we realized how large the subsidies from the government were that were supporting these families
mm-hmm.
when dad was in yeshiva. So in this case, two-thirds of their income, if dad was studying in yeshiva, two-thirds of the income was coming from charity and from the Israeli government
mm-hmm.
in various forms. And then people say, well, what about the wives? Aren't the wives working? They said, well, yeah, the wives were working, but they were also supporting six or seven children, and the birth rates were actually rising.
Mm-hmm.
So by the mid-1990s, they'd gone from six or seven to seven or eight children per woman on average.
Which is completely contradictory to the general population trend in Israel at large, right?
Yeah, and in the world at large, where fertility decline is the rule
mm-hmm.
in almost all of the world today. And yet, ultra-Orthodox Jews in Israel were experiencing fertility increase. Very, very unusual.
Mm-hmm.
And so then we started asking what was going on and how this could be. And frankly, I puzzled over it for about a year and a half, maybe 2 years, until someone showed me this remarkable paper that had been written about Mormons by my friend now and yours, Larry Iannacone,
mm-hmm.
who just explained the whole thing, why it is that strict religious practices, prohibitions and sacrifices would be combined with active mutual aid within communities,
mm-hmm.
with segregation from the rest of society, and with low secular education,
mm-hmm.
and with high or even rising fertility rates.
Yeah, that article by actually there's a number of articles by Larry Iannacone on this issue, and we're trying to get him on Research on Religion. It's just one of the best articles I've seen written on collective action recently. One of the articles was called "Sacrifice and Stigma," and the issue of if your community is going to provide some kind of social welfare services for your community, you have to basically figure out who is going to be contributing to that and who is going to be free riding, and you want to exclude the free riders beforehand.
Absolutely. You know, it's one of those rare events you get as a scholar
mm-hmm.
where you read something and all of a sudden a puzzle which was really bothering you becomes clear.
Yeah.
I could recreate for you where I was sitting and how my feet were up on the desk and what the spot on the ceiling looked like when I got that flash, when I realized, reading Larry's work, how all the pieces fit together. It was just a stunning moment for me.
Mm-hmm.
And it was exactly about that. It was about the free riders. It's about this idea that if you're running a mutual aid organization, and think of any mutual aid organization, like a family,
mm-hmm.
how sensitive you are to everybody pulling the wrong way,
mm-hmm.
and how vulnerable you would be to somebody, you know, taking according to their ability and giving according to their perceived need,
right.
as opposed to the opposite, what they're supposed to do in a commune, which is it taking according to their need and giving according to their ability.
Right.
And so once you understand how sensitive these organizations are, these voluntary mutual aid organizations are, to being gamed or being exploited
mm-hmm.
by free riders, then you understand why, once you create an organization like that, which we like to call a club,
mm-hmm.
why you have to put these mechanisms in place to protect the club
mm-hmm.
from free riders. And there are really two mechanisms, right? One is when people are recruited, you have to recruit very carefully to make sure you're not recruiting people who will free ride.
Right.
And so you ask for signals of commitment up front.
Mm-hmm.
And that might be the many years spent doing non-materialistic things, like studying the holy texts in the yeshiva.
Mm-hmm. Or potentially.
And the other thing you want to do is impose prohibitions on people you've recruited already,
mm-hmm.
so that which distance them from the secular culture or from the attractions of secular consumption.
Mm-hmm.
And those, from an economist point of view, just act as consumption taxes, really.
Mm-hmm.
So here I mean the dietary restrictions and the Sabbath restrictions and all the things you do that make earning and consumption less attractive.
Right. It's also, I mean, it gets down to the point, too, of wearing certain style of clothes or appearing differently because that, you know, it restricts you from other types of activities. If you are, you know, an Orthodox or an ultra-Orthodox Jew, you know, you can't go out drinking in the evenings with your friends and such. And so that limits your activity. The same thing, you know, we could say with the Mormons or the Amish is that when you see somebody from the Amish in Pennsylvania, you know that their options are basically limited for them. And that binds them closer to the group.
Yes. As an example, there's a famous case in London where an ultra-Orthodox Jew was caught wearing jeans and a t-shirt on the wrong side of town.
Mm.
And that alone was grounds for divorce.
Mm-hmm.
Because if he was dressed like that, there was only one thing he could have been doing, and that was enough.
Mm-hmm. And so those signals become, you know, remarkably important for, you know, weeding out any free riders before they get there. Because, you know, when you come into this club, if you don't, you know, abide by these rules, dress this certain way, have these certain dietary restrictions, we're not going to let you in.
Right? Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And, you know, most churches would have kind of a lax form of that,
mm-hmm.
or most synagogues or mosques would have, you know, some norms and rules that are expected of you, and if you don't follow them, then we'll look at you askance, or we might even kick you out.
Mm-hmm.
But in these radical religious groups, the rules are much stricter, and the consequences of not following the rules are much more dire.
Right.
They will kick you out, and your daughters will never be able to marry in our community.
Mm-hmm. If you spent a long time actually sacrificing and doing these things, as you mentioned with the Taliban ban before, you don't have any other skills beyond this, and so I guess it sucks to be you if you get kicked out.
Absolutely. It's like being cast out on the iceberg.
Mm-hmm. And now to relate this back to you know, what we're talking about in other groups, you in your book you talk about the defection constraint and how that is really damaging for any type of rebel organization that might be out there. And it seems that the way that the ultra-Orthodox Jews or the Amish have solved their collective action problem is going to help with this defection constraint as well, too. Is that correct?
Yeah. So if you wanted to get into some other activity that's sensitive to defection, and you're already running a mutual aid organization, you've got a leg up.
Mm-hmm.
On the secular nationalists or the warlords, whoever else is going to try to, you know, enforce non-defection through terror or other incentives. And so now it's not so surprising that if a radical religious group decides to become violent or even to become politically active, they'll do a very, very good job of it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly what we see in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in Lebanon, in Palestine. To some extent, we might be seeing it in the southern Philippines as well.
Mm-hmm. And you use the example of Hamas to illustrate this as well, which is a classic example. Hamas kind of finding its, I guess, heredity or its background in the Muslim Brotherhood, right?
Yes. Though you know, so Hamas is the one that is very familiar to us.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's well documented. It happened in the West Bank and in Gaza, you know, very close to a very active media.
Mm-hmm.
But Hezbollah was really doing this first.
Okay.
In southern Lebanon. And if we go back historically, the Muslim Brotherhood,
mm-hmm.
which was founded in Egypt in the 1930s, really, I think, invented the model
mm-hmm.
of a radical religious group which quickly kind of expands to being a full-fledged social service provision organization
mm-hmm.
in a place where the government was doing a terrible job of social service provision, and then morphed into becoming a nationalist political movement.
Mm-hmm. So document a little bit of that history for our listeners who might not be fully aware of what the Muslim Brotherhood did. You said this starts back in the middle part of the 20th century, and Egypt is not being really good at providing basic social services to, you know, your everyday Egyptian, and Muslim Brotherhood steps in here. Pick up that story there.
So political radical Islam
mm-hmm.
Starts in Egypt in the 1930s And then maybe about a decade later, in pre-mandatory India, in say mandatory British India, mm-hmm. and also among Muslims. And both these movements kind of historically parallel each other, and they only join when kind of a Saudi subsidized version gets to Pakistan. But just sticking with the Egyptian version, so there's a man named Hassan al-Banna who kind of starts this up, and it's an organization which is religious, it like many organizations, mm-hmm. in its infancy. And so clerics like al-Banna are preaching that there's something that people could do better.
Mm-hmm.
Much like you might hear an evangelical pastor
mm-hmm.
preaching that people in their own personal lives could be doing a much better job, mm-hmm. and we as communities could be doing a much better job in supporting ourselves. And then you start to see institutional innovations and institutional development, so which go beyond the mosques. So now you start seeing healthcare provided and education provided. This is all fairly standard among traditional Muslim, Jewish, or even Christian communities
right.
in places where governance is weak.
Mm-hmm.
And then it starts branching out, and all of a sudden they're actually running factories. And they've got it kind of... So this is like Catholic services
mm-hmm.
that we, you know, a very well-organized charitable organization which doing great stuff, but now it's also got kind of an industrial wing to it. And then at some point, the government starts getting worried that they'll become political, and they do. They object to British rule of India, which British weren't directly ruling, but they were ruling through a proxy
mm-hmm.
king. And then eventually, they become very strongly nationalist. They start running in elections. They support the Palestinian revolt against the British mandate in Palestine. And then when when Nasser's officers' rebellion eventually overturns the government and throws the British out for good, that's actually done in the 1950s with the support of the Muslim Brotherhood.
Mm-hmm.
But then Nasser becomes uncomfortable with the Muslim Brotherhood.
It's a rival for power and public in the provision of public services, right?
Yes. So the way that the Nasserites would tell the story is that they try to assassinate Nasser.
Mm-hmm.
The way the Muslim Brethren might tell the story is that those secular officers were smoking and drinking
mm-hmm.
and being un-Islamic, and that wasn't what they bought into. But either way, there was an there's a purported assassination plot, or maybe a true assassination plot, and 6,000 of the leaders of the Muslim Brotherhood are rounded up in Egypt. But then Nasser does something else which turns out to be very wise, it looks like. Instead of just rounding up the leadership, which any dictator can do,
mm-hmm.
he also nationalizes the social service provision organization.
Mm-hmm.
So all the clinics and the schools and the factories become part of the property of the Egyptian government and start providing the same services as the Egyptian government.
Mm-hmm.
And that effectively shuts down the Muslim Brotherhood as political opposition for two decades, which, you know, in retrospect now, looking back at it from 2010, that looks like really quite an accomplishment.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Imagine shutting down the Taliban for two decades.
Right. Right.
The other part of the story that's really relevant for us is that the roots of Al-Qaeda are actually planted at that point.
Mm-hmm.
Because the captured leaders eventually generate a much more virulent form of radical Islam, which it believes that attacking Muslims or Muslim rulers
mm-hmm.
Is actually fair game.
Right.
And from that comes the ideology of Al-Qaeda, with the ideologues of Al-Qaeda. And actually, and the most talented terrorists are for the most part Egyptians.
Mm-hmm.
And that starts taking place in Saudi Arabia, and that feeds into the bin Laden story.
Mm-hmm. And now, so we talked a little bit about the ideological motivations for this, that Nasser's secular attempts to, you know, absorb a lot of what the Muslim Brotherhood was doing, it becomes a target now. But on top of that, I mean, this, going back to what you were talking about before, this club model of religious organizations, I mean, this is really what allows these groups to flourish. You know, so I assume that Al-Qaeda and, you know, other groups are actually adopting this kind of, you know, provision of welfare model associated with it, but also trying to weed out any free riders within the central activists of the group. Is that correct?
Well, Al-Qaeda is kind of a special case. It's the most complicated one to explain, just because it's transnational in its nature.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know for sure.
Okay.
For the other groups, we know. Hezbollah is a club. Hamas is a club. The Taliban are a club. Sadr's militia. The Mahdi army show the signs of being a club. Aum Shinriko, certainly a club. Lashkar-e-Taiba, absolutely a club.
Mm-hmm.
Al-Qaeda, a little more complicated. They don't seem to be providing a lot of services in the places in which they train and attack.
Mm-hmm.
They do seem to be recruiting from groups that look like clubs. And so they're solving, remember, the most important thing about the club was getting your recruitment right.
Mm-hmm.
So what they would, if you can recruit among clubs and then train, carry out your operations somewhere else, often in some other country. So if you can recruit, say, in Yemen and Saudi Arabia,
mm-hmm.
But then train and carry out your attacks in Pakistan or Afghanistan,
mm-hmm.
Then you gain the benefits of the club on the one hand, but you're not exposing the club itself to prosecution,
mm-hmm.
By governments on the other. And that's part of what makes Al-Qaeda such a dangerous organization,
mm-hmm.
The transnational nature of it.
Well, let me try to think through this in terms of some of the policy implications for dealing with a number of these groups. I mean, the fact that they are clubs, and when we talk about clubs, we, you know, it seems to have an innocuous meaning to it, but, you know, what we are largely talking about here when we talk about clubs is the ability to exclude individuals that come in. So a lot of these groups have these club nature and provide social welfare services. So what does that suggest for policy implications for dealing with this if you were, you know, with the U.S. military or any other type of, you know, government throughout the world that's concerned about some of these more radical groups that are engaging in violence?
So, Tony, I'm going to have to clip the answer to this one.
Okay.
Just because I'm sorry, I have another obligation. But I the bottom line is that many of the implications in dealing with clubs are the same as those in dealing with a conventional kind of a hearts and minds insurgent.
Mm-hmm.
What you want to do is improve the quality of governance to such an extent that the club can't set up shop by providing mutual aid in the first place.
Mm-hmm. Basically create a rival service provider at a lower cost for individuals so that the club is no longer attractive.
Absolutely. Get governance so good that there's no opening.
Yeah.
Now, that said, there are differences between the type of kind of hearts and minds counterinsurgency that's being practiced today in Iraq and Afghanistan and kind of an anti-club type of what we might call counterterrorism. And that is, when you're dealing with a club, it's extremely important to compete with them directly in the service that they're the best at providing.
Mm-hmm.
So in Afghanistan, the Taliban don't provide a lot of services, but the ones they do extremely well. Security and dispute adjudication,
mm-hmm.
are the ones that they provide really well, and that's where one would want to compete head-to-head. And unfortunately, our ally, the Karzai government, and our development organizations have not been very good at competing on those two very important aspects,
mm-hmm.
security and dispute adjudication. Security, of course, we're good at, but dispute adjudication and the justice system, we're unfortunately not.
Creating a basic system of rule of law.
Catch up on that one.
Yeah. So, and it's difficult. I mean, as a political scientist, one of the most critical questions that we have is how does a nation set up the basic functions of rule of law? And, you know, I have to admit, as a political scientist, we don't have very good answers for that, and we've still been searching for them. Well, Ellie, it's been good talking with you. I know you have to run. You're extremely busy with a number of research projects that you're doing, including expanding upon this. And I urge anybody who is really interested in this topic to pick up Ellie's book called Radical Religious and Violent, The New Economics of Terrorism. Incredibly insightful book that takes a completely different perspective on terrorism that you might hear pundits or newscasters talking about. And again, it's a very highly readable book, so I urge everybody to pick up a copy of that. Ellie, I want to thank you for being on Research on Religion. I hope to talk to you soon.
Tony, as always, it's a pleasure. Take care.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Before we finish up today, there are a few housekeeping details that I need to attend to. First, you can now find Research on Religion on Twitter under our login name, RORcast. That's RORcast, all one word. Make it easier, sign up with our Twitter account listed on our homepage. Don't worry, we won't fill your inbox with spam. We just want to send you one weekly reminder so that you don't miss any guests or topics that you might be interested in. Second, we will have a common feature coming soon that will allow you to participate in the discussion. Stay tuned for that. Finally, we would like to hear from you. So if you have made it this far in the podcast, please send me an email at tgill@uw.edu. That's tgill@uw.edu. Just to let me know that you're listening. Feel free to suggest changes that you would like to see or guests that you would like to hear. I will try to best accommodate the advice that I receive. And don't forget to tell a friend. We'd love the company and hope that this podcast becomes a great success with your help. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.